Welcome to the commentary. I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church.
And I'm poet and musician Cameron Brooks. The commentary is an in-depth conversation about vision, worship, and life at Grace. In this episode, we are going to be talking about raising grace-centered, gospel-centered kids. And I want to start with a little story to set us up. So, some listeners will know that I became a father about a year and a half ago. So I'm still learning a lot. This is our first child. And Jenny and I subscribe to a little book series, actually put out by Dolly Parton, of all people, where she sends out, in all of her wealth, she created this program where she sends out a free book to anyone who subscribes. I think monthly or something. I think it's once a month. And you know, most of the books have been good, surprisingly good, or at least neutral. But we got a bad one recently, and it was called No Bunny's Perfect. No Bunny's Perfect. And so I sat down with Rudy, we started reading this book, and you think, reading the title, that it would be about living with your imperfections, realizing that no one's perfect, no bunny's perfect, and that's okay. That was not really the moral of the story. The moral of the story was, in fact, that there are good bunnies and there are bad bunnies, and you want to be a good one.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it described in great detail what bad bunnies are like and what they do and why that's bad and why you shouldn't be like that. And we threw the book away. It was free, but anyway, this book got me thinking about the puzzle of moral formation with kids. And we're already conscious of the things we're teaching Rudy. He's only 19 months old, but of course we want to raise him knowing right and wrong, to be sure, but not being a little moralist, a little Pharisee.
Yeah.
And of course, on top of that, as Christians, we want to raise him to know and love and believe the gospel. But how to do that is very difficult. So I, one last qualifier before we get going is I want to say to all you parents out there listening, I know that there are so many books about all sorts of parenting topics out there, including this, and I've read very few of them. So we're probably going to miss some good points in this conversation, but I also trust Pastor Mark and all of your experience with our kids at Grace that you've got some things to say. And hopefully this will be worthwhile for all the parents out there.
Well, I think you're right, though, when you point to all of the books out there.
Yeah.
And there's so much out there telling you how to be a good parent, how to avoid being a bad parent, different methods for parenting. And to me, although, I mean, clearly, you know, it's helpful and it's something people have a lot of questions about. There wouldn't be all those books if there weren't people asking questions. At the same time, when you have so much written about the right or the wrong way to do things and so many theories behind it, I just think what an enormous amount of pressure that can be on parents. You know, I think there probably are a lot of parents who are just curious about what's the best way to approach the task of raising kids. But I also think there are probably a pretty good number who are just sort of like, so much is expected of us, we're going to need all the help we can get. I don't want to be judged as a bad parent, so I need to figure out how to be a good parent. So I think that's maybe another qualifier, you know, that right at the outset, so we talk about the task of parenting, we probably don't want to suggest or talk about it in ways that make it seem like an extra burden, right? Like there's a way that if you do not take it, you will destroy your children's happiness and it will all be your fault. So just put that out there as well. But I love the question, you know, especially at a church like Grace, I think we should be asking how to approach the moral instruction of young people in ways that don't encourage moralism. You know, because we believe in a theology of grace. We say that theology should create a culture of grace, and a big part of the culture of our community has to do with how we instruct young disciples. And so there needs to be a consistency to that. So I think it's a really good question to be asking. So let me just ask you, with 19 months, you know, Rudy is still pretty young, but when you think about the task of moral instruction, what does that look like to you? Like, what are the things that, what are the teachable moments like?
Right. Yeah, well, it's tough to know what he picks up on at this point. So, but I'm trying to be aware of those sorts of moments where essentially we can lead by example and say, in this moment, this is why we do this. This is why this matters. This is why we don't do this. We're trying to learn about sharing lately, the idea of sharing, which is a strange thing to teach. Right. But so it's what I'm finding so far is that you come upon moral instruction moments more than teachings, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things people will sometimes say is that the experience of parenting reinforces their sort of theological sense of human depravity.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, there is a kind of romanticized idea that we're sort of born innocent and that everything would be fine if only we weren't corrupted by society. But then you realize that children have to be taught to share. You know, like you're saying, there's certain things that need to be instilled and encouraged, that if that were the case, that we're all just born innocent, you'd think they would come naturally.
Right.
Right. And so there's this something interesting that happens when you find like you're responsible for the moral formation of a young human who, left to his own devices, might go in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So. No, it's true. And so I think that's what alerts me to my responsibility when I start to feel that a little bit. Oh, he needs to be told what's right and wrong. Even if deep down he knows, because he has an innate moral compass of sorts. But so the dilemma that I alluded to earlier is that I think it's important for our kids to know right and wrong and to feel that. And so therefore we need to teach them the Ten Commandments, for example. And we speak about the law as Christians. It's important that our kids know the law. But Christians talk about the law in lots of different ways. Sometimes the law is really apparently meant to reveal your sin more than anything. Paul talks about that sometimes. But then we also talk about the law sometimes as an instructor, giving us guidance as to how you should actually live your life. So let's pause there and just talk about how our tradition uses the law as more than just something that shows you your sin.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the law functions in a variety of ways.
Right.
And probably the most important way is the sense in which the law reveals the character of God, right? That God, in giving his law, gives us a sense not only of holiness and righteousness in the abstract, but of his own character and who he is. And I think some parts of the law make that more apparent than others. Right, we think about some of the great commands to love one another, to love God with all that you are. Those clearly reveal to us the character of God. When you get into the details of dietary laws in the Old Testament, you might say to yourself, "I don't see how this accomplishes the same task." And I acknowledge, like some, it's clearer than in others, but. But I would say the most important task of the law is that, you know, to sort of outline righteousness. But because it outlines righteousness, it also serves that other task of showing us where we fall short.
Yeah.
You know, and so we oftentimes, in talking about, especially the relationship between the law and the gospel,
mm-hmm.
are emphasizing that other sense in which the law is like the mirror held up to us, showing us how far we fall short. And that reveals to us our need for grace.
Yeah.
The law serves other purposes as well. You know, the law is also in practical matters, in civil society, that sort of thing. The law can give us a framework to think about how we should order our societies and our lives as well. So it can do a lot,
yeah.
But I think in the context of, let's say, nurturing and educating a young person, that positive sense of what does righteousness look like, and that sort of accompanying, well, what happens when you're not righteous, are kind of the two important factors there.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Yeah, keep going.
Well, I was just going to say there's a way, though, that if you're kind of operating primarily in that sense of law, what you begin to instill is exactly moralism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if I say, well, God's righteousness is revealed in the law, you should be righteous, therefore keep the rules. And when you don't keep the rules, God gets mad.
Yeah.
You don't want that. So keep the rules. And if you imagine the relationship between our Heavenly Father and our earthly fathers, oftentimes the way we think of our Heavenly Father is shaped by that relationship with an earthly father. If you imagine a father who, when I don't do what he wants, he gets mad. I don't want to make him mad, so I better do what he wants. That way I will earn his favor. I mean, that in a nutshell is that sort of quote unquote religious moralist framework, to imagine God that way. He gets mad when you don't do the right thing. You don't want to provoke him, so you better do the right thing, that kind of thing. So that even when we think about grace and forgiveness, we think of it primarily as a way of making him not be mad anymore, you know, so that we don't have the bad thing happen to us. So, yeah, I mean, I think we do face a challenge because you don't want to instill moralism, but you do need to outline what righteousness is.
Yeah.
And so how do you do that?
Yeah.
No.
That's the question.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking through my childhood, mm-hmm. raised in the Lutheran church, because yeah. there's that pretty distinct difference in that tradition anyway, between the law and the gospel.
Right.
And I did have a sense that, I don't know if I had a sense that the law was bad,
mm-hmm.
or that I was just bad and against the law. I definitely knew that, but the law, I don't know. In some Lutheran circles, the law is seen as in a negative light, which points you to the hope of the gospel, and that's good. It took me a long time to see the gospel eventually, but what I want for my son anyway is for him to see the goodness of the law and yet to see that he fails, but then to trust in Jesus and to still see the goodness of the law, if that makes sense.
It does.
And that's so strange. And one of the big dilemmas of the New Testament, I guess, Paul trying to figure that question out.
Mm.
Yes, Jesus saves you from your sin before the law, and the law is not bad, and you should still keep it, kind of a thing, with some qualifiers.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's take that desire that you just expressed, like, this is what I want for my son.
Yeah.
And think about that for a little bit, because I don't want to over-theologize. Like, I want to be practical and addressing it. And I think that desire that you just named is exactly the thing to think about. So let me tell you a story. You might think of this as a horror story or a failure. So when it doesn't go the way you hope it does. So we're looking at 19 months for your son. I was teaching at a Worldview Academy camp and got to have some interesting conversations with a young man there, probably 15 years old. And during the course of these, as he was asking his questions, he, you know, basically came out and said, I don't think I can be a Christian. And I'm like, okay, why? And he says, because I'm not good enough. And he started giving me examples. My mom says I should tidy up my room, but I don't do it. Or she says, you know, the music I'm listening to isn't good, but that's what I like. And things like that, you know, and it was all very rules-based, all very moralistic. And so, you know, two things came to my mind. The first thing was I really need to talk to this young man about grace. Mm. Secondly, I wish I could go to his church and confront the pastor who instilled this moralistic gospel in him and sort of made him think that, you know, to be a Christian, you have to just be good. And my wish was fulfilled, because at the closing of the camp that week, his pastor came to pick up the group of kids that they had brought and introduced himself to me. And to my horror, he was a fellow PCA pastor. Mm. And the whole week I'd been thinking, man, this kid's church really did a number on him. Like, I don't know what kind of crazy moralistic message they're putting out there. But when I met his pastor and realized that it's the same kind of church as ours, I was just flummoxed. And so I had to ask. And so I, you know, brought it up to the pastor, and the pastor was like, you know what? I've had this conversation with him again and again. His mother has had this conversation with him again and again. He just doesn't get it. And the moral of the story is that no matter what you do, it doesn't guarantee the outcome. And some people have that moralistic framework. It's not their parents' fault. It's not their church's fault or anything like that. The reality is that moralism is baked into human nature, that our sort of fallen tendency leads us to take that moralistic direction. It's the reason why we twist scriptural religion into a moralistic system, right? So right at the outset, you have to recognize that on the one hand, we have a desire not to go this route, but you can say all the right things and it may not get through. And also some people do all the wrong things and it doesn't matter because, you know, the kid still turns out okay. So it takes a little bit of pressure off, I think, on the one hand, that as a parent, you're not responsible for every outcome. You're not going to get it all right. You don't have to. On the other, though, I think it raises just a different kind of realization, which is that it's a deeper ingrained problem than we often think, right? People are not raised to be moralists because they read a wrong book as a kid, or because, you know, their dad got angry when they disobeyed and was benign when they didn't, or something like that. And like, they're moralistic because they're human. And it's really difficult to push back against that. So at the outset, we have to recognize that just because our church talks about grace doesn't mean that the kids who grow up in our church will just automatically get grace and not be moralistic, right? It's like weeds in a garden. If you don't pull them up, they're going to grow. And so we have to ask ourselves, what's the program for pulling them up? Like, what do we do? And if that's the question, then I want to suggest to everyone listening that the answer is actually staring us in the face. And the answer is in the baptismal vows that all of our parents take when their children are baptized. We've been baptizing a lot recently, adults and children. Mm-hmm. And those vows are especially fresh in my mind. But I think it's so easy to recite them and to witness them and not pay attention to what they're saying. So can I just refresh your memory? As someone who's taken these vows, the third vow that parents take when we baptize their children is an outline of commitments. There's five commitments that a parent makes. And I think actually this is a really good roadmap for raising a child rightly. So we promise, first, in humble reliance upon divine grace. Second, that you will endeavor to set before your child a godly example. Third, that you will pray with and for your child. Fourth, that you will teach your child the doctrines of our holy religion. And finally, that you will strive by all the means of God's appointment to bring your child up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So those five things, you might think of four tasks with an introductory note, are, I think, the answer to this question. So the introductory note is that we promise an humble reliance upon divine grace. And I'll just say that I think the most important thing for a parent who's anxious about raising kids to understand grace is that the parents understand grace.
Yeah.
That there is no book or formula or theory that would substitute for the absence of that understanding. I think parents who understand God's grace and who delight in God's grace, even if they don't have the right words to convey it or they don't adopt the right system, it will come across and it will leave its impression on every member of the household. So if we're not humbly relying on divine grace, nothing else that we do is going to make an impact.
Right. Yeah. And presumably you could even approach this question legalistically. We've sort of been hinting at that the whole time, I think. Yeah, that parents tend to get legalistic about raising kids that aren't legalists.
Like, yeah,
I need to get this right, and I'm gonna make sure that I show grace or something contradictory like that. This doesn't make sense, but I hear what you're saying. One time I asked my brother-in-law this question, basically, what's the best parenting book that you've ever read? And he was like, the gospel. He just said the best thing is for you to live out and show your kid the gospel. And I think that's what you're saying. It's this reliance on divine grace and everything.
Yeah, yeah. And that is the first of those commitments in the vow, that you will endeavor to set before your child a godly example. And I think you can't really exaggerate the importance of that, right? Like you need to be transformed by grace. And you want to set an example of grace to your child. That godly example is probably more important than any instruction that you give.
Right.
Right. Especially when you think about the relationship between fathers and sons, mothers and daughters. There's that patterning that goes on where your idea of what you aspire to be, what kind of man you're going to become, what kind of woman you're going to be, is really shaped by the example of a parent, and not intentionally. You know, it's not that you've crafted an example. It's that you set an example by your life. And so it works, you know, both ways. I mean, some of us are deeply shaped by bad examples. Let's say unintentional examples. And so, although it sounds odd, I guess it's a little bit like the advice that you get on the airplane, that you've got to put your mask on first before you can help a dependent put on their mask. Because although it's counterintuitive, until you've done that for yourself, you're not in a position to minister to the other. And so I think that the decisions that you make, being a person who lives your faith out, who takes your commitment seriously, and your children can see that, if they see that you are self-sacrificial, if they see that you give forgiveness to those who wrong you, then from that godly example, they learn. And so I think, you know, if it's the case that we learn moralism through moralistic examples, well, then grace through gracious examples. And so that should be an encouragement to us to be really serious about living our faith before our kids. And maybe that's the other part of it, is that, I mean, you're going to live your faith to the best of your ability, but there's another layer of intention in terms of living it out in front of your kids,
right?
So that they can actually witness it and understand it, ask questions about it. And so I think being intentional about that is really important. And if you keep them secluded from it, that doesn't happen as much, you know? So a good example would be the next commitment, that you will pray with and for your child. And this is one of those things I think is so easy to take for granted, you know, the now I lay me down to sleep moments, and sentimentalized in so many family films. But the reality is, your child will learn to pray by praying with you. And you want to be praying for them as well. You know, so something as simple as that, I think, again, it's not about instilling virtue. It's not about setting rules and making sure they're kept. It's more fundamental than that. You know, interceding with your child to God and on behalf of your child as a foundation,
right,
for those other things. It's only after that that we say, you will teach your child the doctrines of our holy religion. But even there, I think that's important, because like, we certainly live in a time when it sounds noble to say, well, I'm not going to force my religion on my kids or something like that. And when we take that attitude, we neglect the commitment that we make in these vows, because God has entrusted us with children and entrusted us to disciple them. And so they should be educated, and they should be equipped with knowledge. And again, if we don't want them to be moralists, teaching them the actual gospel is a big part of the answer. Right, directly addressing the faults of moralism and the need for grace, I think, is you live it out as an example, you live it out in the life of prayer, and then you explain it in teaching. You know, you answer the questions, and you say, this is why we do what we do and live as we do.
Yeah, that's good. I've noticed in myself probably a misunderstanding, if that's the right way of putting it. But sometimes I think, well, I know that Rudy is fallen, like we were talking about earlier, and that he needs a divine work of grace in his heart to awaken him to respond to the gospel. Until then, the law is just going to be condemnation. And almost, I haven't worked this all through, but I think I've in my subconscious is a tendency to think that the gospel has to wait for that conviction of sin and repentance and faith for it to mean anything. But that's, of course, completely wrong, that the gospel always needs to be preached for it to be believed. The gospel needs to be lived out for it to be seen and accepted. So even as we trust God to work in our children, we are from the very start showing them the gospel and telling them the gospel in hopes that God uses that to enliven them to faith. So
maybe a helpful analogy would be to think about kind of the stages of learning, in especially in classical education. I don't know how familiar you are, but the revival of interest in classical education over the last 30 years or so, motivated in large part by Dorothy Sayers' essay in The Lost Tools of Learning. That's the essay where she lays out the idea that there are these stages of learning. You know, you go from the grammar stage to the logic stage to the rhetoric stage, and she connects those subjects with the sort of age and capacity of the students. So younger students are in the grammar stage. They're being taught the rules, given the building blocks. In the logic phase, those kids kind of in the middle of that journey are using the things that they've learned to kind of work out the implications and see the structures, how it works. And then in that final rhetoric stage, these older kids on the foundation that's already been built of knowledge and sort of the use of that knowledge, then do these more creative things, or they're thinking more deeply and laterally about what they've learned. And one of the interesting things about this is that that last stage is dependent upon the work that's been done before. And it really matters that the different topics be approached at the different sort of stages of development. Mortimer Adler has written a lot about this in more detail, you know, where there are certain methods of teaching best suited to certain topics, best suited to certain sort of types of students and age groups, that sort of thing. So you can really go into the weeds on this. But if you just take that idea of there being this kind of spectrum that's age-based and different stages of development, different knowledge appropriate to them, and then come back and think about this question. I think in that grammar stage of a young person's life, there's a need to learn all of those building blocks, you know, to be able to be told right from wrong, to be corrected, and to have instilled in them that moral foundation. And then they're going to build on it in that logic phase and start thinking about those moral questions. And they'll start asking questions for the Big Question podcast, like the apparent contradictions in their understanding.
Yeah.
And then eventually they'll be thinking in very theological ways about all of this in that more, you know, rhetoric stage. But I think the mistake we often make is that none of us enjoyed that early stage. And some of us have, you know, pretty negative memories of that. And as a result, we think the gracious thing to do would be to have it be grace from the beginning always.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. And I think there's a sense in which that's good. But there's another sense in which it's a little bit like doing rhetoric with kids you should be doing grammar with, and making it all rhetoric, you know, that you're trying to do this profound theological thing with a person who doesn't have the foundational understanding to be able to see why that matters. And I think not only is it counterproductive, but what it does is, I think it frustrates and baffles the student on the sense of what grace actually is, right? Because if I'm always there to tell you the rules don't really matter, if I'm always there to tell you that breaking the rules is fine because I'm going to love you no matter what, and, you know, everything's going to be okay and all that, are we instilling an appreciation of grace, or are we instilling a sort of antinomian sense that none of this really matters anyway? And I think sometimes it's the latter, right? That we've all had this experience before of, you know, kids whose parents have, with the best of intentions, given them, let's say, a lack of structure. And as a result, they don't know how to behave. They don't know how to make those moral choices, and they're not open to correction or something like that. That I think you want to avoid. Like, we don't want, in the name of grace, to just say, okay, kids, run wild, and we'll just sort of tell you abstractions about, you know, how it's all fine until you finally understand or something. So I think that law gospel distinction is helpful in the sense that in a evangelistic setting, we might say, if you're going to understand your need for the gospel, first you have to have that conviction of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, especially early on, instilling discipline, teaching those lessons at an age appropriate level is really important, you know? And so
But surely you're not suggesting that we withhold grace.
No, of course.
From children.
No, but I think the important thing, I think, is that we're equipping them with the knowledge to fully understand that. So you can explain grace, but without having that foundation, I think it's going to be really difficult to understand what it is, right? Like, grace is not a kid doing bad things and then crying to get out of punishment, right?
Right.
I think the reality of the justice of the punishment leads us to the need for the grace, mm-hmm. and the gratitude for the grace, right? So if obedience is a result of gratitude for forgiveness, then you have to be able to appreciate that gift in order to feel that gratitude. So on the one hand, you know, you don't want to be a tyrant who's demanding, you know, obedience at all costs and cracking the whip, as it were. But on the other hand, there should be structure and discipline. Human beings need that and thrive on it. And withholding it at a stage of development where it's the thing you need most isn't gracious, right? So we want to talk in age-appropriate ways about all these things. But I think what I'm trying to say is for a parent who's concerned that, you know, my very young child just seems to need the rules. And if they're going to behave and do what's right, then I have to be stern with them. And it just makes me feel like, quote unquote, the God of the Old Testament. I guess what I'm saying is at a certain age of development, that's probably what it's going to be like. And it doesn't mean that grace isn't present. Grace was present in the Old Testament. But one's understanding of grace becomes fuller with time. So again, I mean, I said we're going to be practical. That's still pretty theologically abstract, but I think what I'm trying to say is that the role of discipline is really important. Mm-hmm. It's important in forming kids. It's important in forming disciples. And we shouldn't think that there's a conflict between that discipline and between the reality of grace.
Right.
It's just that we're going to need God's grace in order to live that life of discipline, if that makes sense. So, yeah, hopefully that helps a little bit. But I think there's a time and place for everything. And when you're at that early stage, kicking yourself that my kid understands punishment but doesn't seem to understand grace, it's like, yeah, and that will come later. You're modeling it, you're teaching it, but they're going to have to get to the point where they have developed enough to understand it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, Paul himself was, I guess, a legalist, you could say, and maybe he understood the gospel and grace in a deeper sense once he encountered Christ because of his background. And again, I know we're not saying that your kid needs to be a legalist before he can understand the gospel.
No.
But I hear what you're saying. And I think it relieves some of the pressure again to snap your fingers and make sure my kid gets it now. Mm-hmm. Because it's true that kids develop in stages and you trust that God is working in them, even if they don't grasp the gospel like you do.
Right.
As someone who's been living it with it for a lot longer.
But like if you were fearful that you were teaching your kid moralism, to me, the thing I would want to point you to is not, okay, teach them this other lesson instead.
Right.
It would be something more like set before them a godly example. You know, that if you can satisfy yourself about the godly example, then the rest can happen in time. If the problem is the godly example is not being set, like if you're instilling moralism because you're not setting the godly example, then work on that. But they're not getting moralism because you're saying it wrong, if that makes sense. Yeah. You know, it's already in there.
Yeah.
We're all that way. Mm-hmm. And it takes a process of cultivation. I think, to bring us to understanding. You know, that the final phrase, commitment in that vow, says that you will strive by all the means of God's appointment to bring your child up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And that's really what it's all about. You're bringing them up over time in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Mm-hmm. So when you think about the things we do in order to accomplish that, like all the means of God's appointment, we worship with our children. We not only instruct our children within families one-on-one, but we do it in the church as well. We kind of pool our resources and try to do that as best we can. And all of those things together are accomplishing this mission, right? So, you know, every parent has that experience of, you know, you tell your kid the same thing over and over again, and then some other person tells it to them and they act like they're hearing it for the first time. That can be frustrating, but the advantage of the church is that that other person is there.
Yeah.
Right? So if they need to hear it, but from someone else, the community is there to provide that, whether it's a Sunday school teacher or a pastor, or it's at a community group meeting or something. There are other adults speaking into the life of your child and reinforcing those things. And so it isn't all up to you in that sense either.
Yeah, that's a good reminder to take the responsibility to set examples for other people's children too, or at least be mindful of it, because sometimes I find myself checking out. Oh, I'm not obligated to give an example to you because you're not my child.
Yeah.
But one, that's not very loving or considerate, but two, it's missing the opportunity and of that community. Like you were talking about, we should be mindful always of the example we're setting for children. And
it's funny, you know, people have a hard time understanding that because you understand how other people encourage you.
Yeah.
And you don't really see how you encourage them.
Right.
Right. So I think about it this way, where, Alyssa, you show up at church one Sunday and you look around and, you know, this person isn't there, or that person isn't there, and you're bummed out that they're not there. It's always encouraging to see them. But you don't really think about it the other way. Like when you're not there, right? It's like, it's only the absence of others that is a discouragement to you. And you don't really think about the way that your presence builds others up. So, you know, that's maybe one example. But if you think about that, not just as like, you know, showing up for a particular act of worship, but showing up in the lives of your own children and the children of other people in your community, that is, you know, how we form young people in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you know, through those examples and through that community.
Which is why that's a part of the baptismal vows too, right?
Right.
Like you turn to the congregation and ask us,
yes,
hey, are you going to take part of this thing? Because you're here witnessing and it's on you as well.
And it would be, you know, moralistic for me to turn around and say, hey, you're checking out and not paying attention to that kid, but you swore a vow that you would help in that child's upbringing. But exactly, you know, and I always hope that there's a comfort in that moment when parents who now have undertaken these weighty vows hear a congregation affirming, yes, we will be with you in this. And so, you know, I don't feel like I have to encourage parents individually to take those vows seriously. There's something about having a child in your care that does the work. But I do want to encourage everyone to take it seriously where we've made commitments to other people's kids. Right? Because I think that is what creates that overlap.
Yeah.
And again, it means that it matters for all of us that we're all modeling that graciousness too, right? And so we don't want moralism to be the legacy in our households, and we don't want it to be the legacy in our church. I guess I'll just say that I think ultimately the way to prevent it is to name it and to fight against it out in the open. So if your kids only ever hear someone push back against moralism when they're at church, it'd be good if they were hearing it at home too.
Yeah.
You know, it would be good when they fall into moralistic traits if you had that conversation with them then, you know, and it'll happen. You'll have a conversation with a child about the other children, which are the good children and which are the bad children, you know? And it's an opportunity to talk through that exact dilemma that kind of started you on this path, that, you know, that they're not going to need a book to tell them there are bad kids on the playground or something. They're going to figure it out. And that there's the opportunity to, I don't know, you know, what effect it has on a 5-year-old to come home and say there's a bad kid at school, and have you say, actually, you're all bad kids. Let your Calvinist father inform you. But you get the idea, you know, that you're actually going to get a lot of opportunities to address that moralism, and you're going to have to. So it's not going to slip by unnoticed,
right?
You know, it's going to be there. And I think the reason why it does get a pass in the church is that obedience and compliance are easiest to secure through sort of moralistic inducement, right? So we punish obedience and we reward obedience and we punish disobedience. We give carrots and we shake sticks. And if that's the way it always works, then yeah, no matter what lip service we pay to grace, the lesson is going to be moralism. Mm-hmm. So sometimes if you're going to instill grace, it's going to be harder than if you're just going to make threats or, you know, suspend privileges or something like that. But you may have to do those other things as well and incorporate and address grace.
Right.
Again, because if you look at the way that our Heavenly Father raises us up in faith, he does all of those things too, right? He instructs his people. He gives commands. He threatens punishment for unrighteousness. All of those things are there. But ultimately, he reveals his grace. And so I think that's the key, is recognizing that we're not choosing law or gospel.
Yeah.
We're not choosing obedience or forgiveness, that all of it does fit together ultimately.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that's what I wanted to hear you say from the outset. Because I do think it's important, of course, for the children to have a deep sense of moral right and wrong.
Yeah.
To call injustice injustice, to see goodness and praise it in the world, and to see something bad and say, that's bad.
Right.
And I think if we start there, inevitably our kids will encounter experiences where there's dissonance in their own lives. Like, because I know what's right and wrong now, I know that I'm not always the right one. And instead of just letting that be subconscious or quiet, like you just said, talking about it.
Yeah.
That dissonance you feel.
Right.
Bring that to the cross. Bring that to Jesus and confess that. And that's what the gospel's able to be preached. So.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point, because, you know, we've been talking about it primarily as, you know, your relationship to your child, so that the disobedience in that equation is the child's disobedience and kind of the need to punish, but also ultimately forgive.
Yeah.
But a lot of their moral intuition and formation is actually formed in response to the world around them. It's what they see other people doing. It's when you've said something is wrong, and then they see someone doing the wrong thing, and they're not condemned for it or punished for it, or maybe even rewarded for it. It's those kinds of inconsistencies that lead to the questions that are worth exploring, right? That help. Because ultimately, we want to raise young people who are conscious not only of, you know, God's call in their life, but also the way in which the world pushes back. You know, that if you're going to follow that call, sacrifice is involved. And we are all so quick to assume that whatever the majority believes is what is right, and to settle those moral questions that way, that being able to instruct a young person that you know, sometimes everybody thinks this, but what's true is that, can be some of the most important moral instruction that there is. You know, so it isn't only when kids mess up that suddenly grace becomes a topic of conversation. Oftentimes it's when they feel that righteous indignation that people are doing things they shouldn't be doing. And you have to acknowledge that and also talk about what it is to be not judging, but forgiving. Yeah. You know.
And here we could plug the importance of, speaking of books, raising your kids with good stories. But that's an episode for a different day, perhaps.
Yeah.
Or maybe we've had done that episode. Who knows? But
well, I think when we began, I never expected that we would handle parenting in a single episode. But hopefully
we've done it.
This has been helpful to people looking to raise their kids in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, but wanting those kids to be grace-centered and not just rule followers. And so I'm sure we'll come back to this in future episodes, but I pray that this will be a good start.
Thank you for listening to The Commentary. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can rate us on your favorite podcast app and share episodes with your friends on social media. You can subscribe to The Commentary on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can find out more about us online and check out our other podcasts by visiting us at graceforsiouxfalls.org.